Something lives at 124 Bluestone Road that shouldn't be there. For 18 years, a dead baby's fury has shaken the walls, shattered mirrors, and driven away anyone who dared to stay. When we meet Seth and her daughter Denver in 1873 Cincinnati, they're the only ones left, two women sharing their home with a vengeful spirit, isolated from neighbors who've learned to cross the street rather than pass their door. This isn't a typical ghost story. It's about what happens when a nation tries to move forward without looking back, when trauma gets buried instead of mourned. Morrison forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. The past doesn't stay past, especially when that past involves wounds as deep as American slavery. After Paul, a man from Seth's enslaved past, temporarily banishes the ghost, something stranger arrives. A young woman appears on their doorstep, exhausted yet pristine, calling herself Beloved, the name carved on a baby's tombstone. When Seth sees her, her bladder releases uncontrollably, waters breaking like childbirth, her body recognizing what her mind resists. Denver, desperately lonely, latches onto this mysterious visitor with fierce devotion. Beloved asks unsettling questions. "Where are your diamonds?" referring to earrings from decades past. She craves sweets insatiably, watches Seth with consuming intensity, and speaks in rhythms both childlike and ancient. Is she Seth's murdered daughter reincarnated? A traumatized survivor of sexual violence? The embodiment of all those lost in slavery's brutality? Morrison deliberately refuses to clarify, making Beloved simultaneously personal ghost and collective memory, one woman's loss and countless unnamed victims demanding acknowledgement. Her presence makes the past tangible, forcing confrontation with what Seth has desperately tried to keep at bay. At the novel's heart lies an act defying easy judgment. Seth killed her own child. Morrison reveals this truth gradually, building context before condemnation. 28 days, that's all the freedom Seth tasted before her former owner arrived to reclaim her under the Fugitive Slave Act. She'd escaped Sweet Home while pregnant, been whipped so brutally her back became a tree of scars, had her breast milk stolen by her owner's nephews in a violation merging sexual assault with maternal desecration. She reached Cincinnati and experienced less than a month of safety before schoolteacher came for her children. In that moment, Seth made her calculation. Death was kinder than slavery. "I took and put my babies where they'd be safe," she explains with devastating simplicity. When Paul Deed challenges that her love was too thick, Seth responds with unwavering conviction. "Love is, or it ain't. Thin love ain't love at all." Morrison refuses moral clarity. Instead, she presents impossible context, a system so brutal it made infanticide seem like mercy, where a mother weighed whether death might be the most loving gift she could offer. The true horror isn't Seth's desperate act, but the world that made it comprehensible. Seth's concept of rememory suggests traumatic experiences embed themselves in places, not just minds. "Places are still there," she tells Denver. "The picture of it stays, out there in the world." Sweet Home Plantation exists perpetually in the present tense, hundreds of miles away, yet always accessible, always dangerous. Paul D. carries his worst memories in a rusted tobacco tin lodged in his chest. When it breaks open, suppressed trauma from a Georgia prison camp, coffin-like boxes, sexual violence, nearly destroys him. He learned to love just a little bit as survival strategy. Denver, born during escape with no direct slavery experience, still inherits this trauma. When a classmate mentions her mother's imprisonment, Denver becomes deaf for 2 years, her body refusing what her mind cannot process. Her hearing returns only when she detects the baby ghost, suggesting that acknowledging rather than suppressing the past enables healing. Morrison's temporal disruption, memories intruding unpredictably into present narrative, mirrors how trauma operates, creating ruptures where past and present coexist rather than progressing linearly. As Beloved's presence intensifies, love transforms into consumption. Seth quits her job, spends their savings on luxuries for Beloved, neglects herself. Beloved, she my daughter, she mine, Seth insists, the possessive language revealing how love becomes ownership. Denver initially thrives in Beloved's companionship, but recognizes the danger. Beloved grows larger while Seth wastes away, as though the past literally feeds on the present. In a haunting stream of consciousness section, their voices merge. You are mine. I am yours. They're claiming mirror slavery's reduction of people to possessions. Beloved's demands become insatiable. Constant stories, attention, affirmation, her needs expanding like unaddressed trauma. Her body swells as though pregnant with denied grief. This cycle ends only when Denver breaks free from 124's isolation and seeks help. Morrison presents this consuming love as both personal tragedy and national metaphor. Unaddressed historical trauma devours those who carry it, and isolation prevents healing. Only by breaking silence and seeking community can the cycle be interrupted. Denver's courage to seek help from Lady Jones sparks the community's redemption. Food arrives anonymously, then with human connection, as women engage Denver directly, acknowledging their 18-year failure. When schoolteacher arrived, neighbors stayed silent, their envy of Baby Suggs's feast overriding their duty to warn. Now they make amends. As Denver gains employment, community members share stories that help her understand Seth with compassion rather than fear. When Seth's condition deteriorates under Beloved's demands, 30 women gather outside 124 for collective exorcism. Their singing creates force powerful enough to counter Beloved's hold. When Seth mistakes an approaching white man for schoolteacher and rushes to attack him, redirecting violence away from her children, the community intervenes, preventing tragedy rather than judging aftermath. Beloved disappears, exorcised or having served her purpose. The novel suggests healing requires collective effort rather than isolated struggle. Then America's unresolved historical traumas similarly demand communal acknowledgement and shared responsibility. The novel concludes with a haunting refrain: this is not a story to pass on. The phrase cuts both ways, too painful to retell, yet too important to forget. The characters decide that remembering seemed unwise, and they forgot her like a bad dream. Yet traces remain, footprints that appear and disappear by the stream, suggesting complete erasure is neither possible nor desirable. Morrison's fragmented chronology, shifting perspectives, and blending of supernatural with historical realism create a reading experience that mirrors trauma's disruptive nature. We become witnesses rather than passive consumers, actively reconstructing the story. The final single-word paragraph, Beloved, insists that despite attempts to forget, the past remains present, demanding acknowledgement. Morrison's fragmented chronology, shifting perspectives, and blending of supernatural with historical realism create a reading experience that mirrors trauma's disruptive nature. We become witnesses rather than passive consumers, actively reconstructing the story. The final single-word paragraph, Beloved, insists that despite attempts to forget, the past remains present, demanding acknowledgement. Acknowledgement that transforms ghosts into ancestors, trauma into testimony, and silence into the difficult, necessary work of collective memory. In an America still grappling with how to teach and remember its racial history, Morrison's masterpiece offers a profound challenge. True healing requires not forgetting, but honest remembering that acknowledges both horror and humanity. We cannot move forward by burying our ghosts. They will return, demanding recognition, growing larger in darkness, until we finally turn toward them, speak their names, and allow the community to bear witness. Only then can the haunting end, not through erasure, but through acknowledgement that transforms ghosts into ancestors, trauma into testimony, and silence into the difficult, necessary work of collective memory.